This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by True Niagen. New True Niagen Pro contains a unique form of vitamin B3, clinically proven to safely increase NAD, which is a vital resource used every day to help fuel and maintain the health of all living cells. NAD is critical for energy and cellular repair and supports muscle function. But as we age, NAD has been found to decline up to 50%. True Niagen Pro is clinically proven to safely increase NAD levels, caring for your cells to help you age better and live better. True Niagen Pro is only available through healthcare practitioners. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com to get yours. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's podcast is devoted entirely to the subject of exercise, a most important subject, I'm sure you'll agree, because exercise is connected to such a wide variety of health benefits. And today we're going to talk to an expert. He's DeWade Perry, MD. Dr. Perry is a physician in Eugene, Oregon. He's trained in conventional medicine, but he is also a superb amateur athlete. He is a bodybuilder, has been for the last decade or so. His athletic exploits are amazing, and it's amazing that he was able to maintain some kind of physical conditioning throughout arduous medical training, because usually people end up physical wrecks after medical school and internship and fellowship training. He's here with us today to answer some of our most important questions about exercise and exercise nutrition. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. DeWade Perry. DeWade, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine once again. This is a reprise of a broadcast that we did about a year ago or so.
Yes, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be here with you and your audience.
It's my pleasure. Okay, first of all, give us a little bit of information about your background. Recently, I was really impressed because you did some sort of push-up challenge that I thought was so incredible. What was that about?
Well, the push-up challenge was a few months ago, and it was a challenge through Facebook, I believe, to bring attention to veteran suicide. And the challenge was to do a certain number of push-ups every day for a month. I believe it was 25 push-ups once a day for a month, and put the video on YouTube. However, I wasn't going to put a video on YouTube every day for a month of me doing 25 push-ups.
Right.
So I just decided to do all the push-ups at once and put the video on YouTube. But just doing simple push-ups is not much of a challenge for me, so I decided to do my feet elevated on a 30-inch block and then wear my weight vest. So it ended up being something like 490-some-odd push-ups.
Oh, no.
And that's what I did.
That is crazy. And is that still up on Facebook if people go to look up DeWade Perry and like you or friend you?
Yes, that's still on Facebook, yes.
Okay, great. That was one of those over-the-top kind of Everest-like achievements that really was unique. But I think that is not an atypical, that is kind of an atypical achievement for you, but you're actually all about an exercise lifestyle. You incorporate daily exercise, and I think you're also involved to some degree in martial arts, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I've been involved with martial arts for several decades now and still train in a couple of different types of martial arts, but certainly martial arts is a big aspect of my training throughout the years.
So absolutely. This is radio, so it's hard to visualize, but could you give people an idea of your physical dimensions, your height and weight?
So actually, I'm fairly short for a male. I'm 5'6". My body weight is about 196 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
My last DEXA scan, though, my body fat percentage was 7.3. So although mm-hmm. my BMI is rather yeah. high, over 30, my body fat percentage is pretty low. So those are my physical stats.
Yeah, you're almost a little bit, you're powerful enough, but almost a little too small to be a fast, nimble halfback or you know, football running back.
Right.
But you certainly could push through a defensive line pretty well with that kind of muscle power. So. So let's get into, you know, some of the basics of exercise. You know, there's this big debate, as you know, and you've been involved in it. I think you also continually post articles about the scientific literature. So it's not just, you're not just offering opinions off the top of your head, because any musclehead can offer an opinion about exercise. But, you know, we want to make it scientifically based on studies and research. The big debate, is strength training superior to aerobic exercise, or do they both have benefits and different strokes for different folks? How would you break it down for us?
Yeah. So it totally depends on the goals of the individual, the goal or the goals of the individual. There are some aspects of health where aerobic training is superior than strength training. And then, of course, there are some aspects of health where strength training is superior to aerobics. So take, for instance, cardiorespiratory fitness. Aerobic training, whether it's high-intensity interval training or whether it's moderate state, long steady state type of training, is going to generally be superior to weight training, unless one is doing a certain type of weight training. Conversely, if you're talking about increasing muscle mass, increasing bone density, then weight training is going to be superior to aerobic training. So it depends on the goals of the person, but that's also why it's important to include both types of training, so you can encompass the entire range of health benefits from exercise.
Okay, so the New York Times recently put up an article, I think you probably saw it, an hour of running may add 7 hours to your life. So I guess that it means if you run once in your life for an hour, you get an extra 7 hours. But I think the point is that if you're a regular runner and you log a lot of miles, you know, I guess this morning I earned an extra, you know, probably about 6.25 hours because I ran just shy of a mile outside because it's nice weather finally here in New York. So I you know, I could just chalk it up on my blackboard. I get 7 hours. Do you agree with that proposition? Is there anything, any scientific basis for supporting that notion?
There have been numerous studies, actually population-based studies, that have looked at running and other types of exercise in relation to longevity, in relation to all-cause mortality, and several other health factors. And I do agree with it. There are certain caveats because in certain aspects of lifestyle that need to be controlled for in those studies. But in general, all of the major studies and big studies have shown that running does increase longevity, does increase lifespan, and, you know, to the degree that it does varies on the person and the amount of running that he or she does. But the studies are pretty consistent. So I do agree with them. But it's not just running. There are other sports. A previous study came out a few months ago that showed racket sports also do the same thing. So there are other sports that can increase longevity and lifespan too.
And of course, the caveat always applies as when you take a medication, you see the advertisements, results may vary. Okay.
Absolutely.
So there are outliers. There are the people who are couch potatoes, you know, who live to be 104. And then there are the the runners, you know, Jim Fix is an example. There's also, what was the name of the guy who ran out in the desert, El Caballo Blanco, whatever the fellow's name was, who was this long-distance runner who dropped dead at a relatively young age. Apparently,
exactly.
I don't even remember his name, but the legendary runner. What about, and you mentioned, you referred earlier to high-intensity interval training. That seems to really be in vogue, and it's a new term, HIIT. And that is thought, and according to a recent study, that's the Rolls Royce of exercise. There's something about the efficiency of HIIT, that seems to be superior to, yeah, you know, I used to go to the Y. Sometimes I see the people on the recumbent bicycles, you know, they're reading the New York Times and they're sort of, you know, pushing a little bit on the pedals and, you know, barely breaking a sweat. And maybe, just maybe, they're getting, you know, a little bit of benefit, but not the true potential of exercise.
Right, exactly. So one quick word about the running, because there's some emerging research now that sort of is warning us about too much running, actually. Mm-hmm. So those individuals who do multiple marathons or ultra marathons, yeah, those type of things, there's some warning about that and whether or not that much endurance exercise is actually causing too much oxidative stress on the cardiovascular system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a sweet spot in terms of exercise, mm-hmm, especially when it comes to endurance exercise. So that point needs to be kept in mind also.
And indeed, we do see a higher incidence of things like atrial fibrillation, enlarged heart.
Right.
And the thought is that maybe some of these very intense bouts of exercise, and usually, you know, most ordinary mortals don't subject themselves to this, but people who do the really heavy duty endurance events may experience micro infarcts of their heart, like little tiny areas of dead heart tissue, which over time accumulate and the heart becomes baggy and enlarged. The conduction system of the heart gets messed up, and these people succumb to cardiovascular illnesses and arrhythmias.
Right, yeah. And also, you may have seen a study from about 2 months ago that showed marathon runners have an acute kidney damage right after their marathon.
Mm.
That was a very interesting study that came about 2 months ago. So right after a marathon, those runners, everyone studied, experiences of acute kidney damage.
Yikes.
That resolved, of course, but it was a very interesting study. In those marathon runners. So just something to keep in mind, absolutely.
Well, it's actually not unheard of, and this has even occurred to me while running as an alarming kind of symptom, usually benign, but suggests something is traumatic, is, you know, you take a really long run, and you go to the bathroom, you know, urinate, and out comes bright amber liquid instead of yellow lemonade colored
right,
liquid. And what that's runner's
right,
hematuria. That's blood in the urine. And that, you know, of course, so, one has to have a workup to make sure one doesn't have a kidney stone or worse yet, cancer. But it's called runner's hematuria, which is from the concussion of running. And
absolutely.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by True Niagen. New True Niagen Pro contains a unique form of vitamin B3, clinically proven to safely increase NAD, which is a vital resource used every day to help fuel and maintain the health of all living cells. NAD is critical for energy and cellular repair and supports muscle function. But as we age, NAD has been found to decline up to 50%. True Niagen Pro is clinically proven to safely increase NAD levels, caring for your cells to help you age better and live better. True Niagen Pro is only available through healthcare practitioners. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com to get yours. Let's tackle the issue of HIIT, H-I-I-T.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
Yeah. So actually, high-intensity interval training is one of my personal favorite types of training because it's short duration. So
yeah, it's efficient.
Basically, HIIT. Exactly. So HIIT involves alternating extreme effort, nearly maximum effort in an activity, and then alternating that with sub-maximal effort. So if one is thinking about running, then one would sprint for a certain time or distance and then have a recovery phase of walking or jogging for a certain time or distance. What's great about HIIT is one can manipulate the different intervals. So one can sprint for, say, 10 seconds and then walk for a minute or 2 minutes or whatever he or she wants to do and just repeat that cycle for a predescribed number of minutes or predescribed number of cycles. And then the session is over. Typically, HIIT sessions do not need to be any longer than, say, 10, 15, 20 minutes compared to more, you know, traditional steady state exercising that can last, you know, 40 minutes to an hour or more. So that's the benefit of HIIT. And then when you look at the further benefits, such as there are some studies that show physique enhancement in terms of body composition modification, mm-hmm. Increased fat oxidation, and some things like that. So there are a multitude of benefits to HIIT, not just the fact that it's a shorter duration. A lot of people enjoy it because it's not boring, because you're exerting a maximum effort. So you are focusing on exactly what he or she is doing and trying to get through it. So it's a very efficient and a lot of people enjoy it actually too. So very good way to train.
Indeed. This reminds me of a scene in American Beauty. I don't know if you remember that movie of the 1990s, I believe it was. Kevin Spacey found himself a young girlfriend, and he was infatuated with her. And all of a sudden, he decided to get off the couch and exercise. So he was out, looking kind of miserable in his workout clothes, trying to jog, and a couple of his neighbors came by. He started chatting them up, and they said, well, what's your exercise goal? Cardiovascular fitness or muscle strength? And he answered, look good naked.
That brings us to
the next topic, which you actually, I mean, look good naked. I mean, I just don't want to embarrass you here, but you're a real, quite proficient bodybuilder. You compete in bodybuilding competitions where it's also about aesthetics and muscle size,
right,
and muscle definition. In the bodybuilding realm, and this is presumably you're not somebody who's juicing on roids and using performance enhancing drugs to achieve
absolutely
your
not
aims,
correct,
because otherwise you're a physician, it would be counterproductive to put aesthetics over health. But
that's absolutely
in working in that way. What is the best way to build muscle strength and create muscle definition? I mean, when I work out, I have the opposite goal. I tell my personal trainer, make me strong, but please, I just bought a bunch of clothes. Don't change my clothes size, because it's going to cost, I'm already paying for, personal training here. It's going to cost me a fortune if I go up to a size 42 or 44, jacket. So,
right.
But your goal is the opposite. You want to have muscle definition. You want to be big. So, number of reps, type of exercise, what kind of routine?
Right. So, well, first of all, the whole concept of toning or muscle definition, as you know, that's going to come from lowering body fat. So that doesn't have as much to do with weight, sets, reps, as it does with nutrition, nutrition side of things, and also the cardio side of things. But when you talk strictly about muscle mass, gaining muscle, and that type of thing, then there are a myriad of routines that one can employ to achieve that goal. And studies support a variety of routines. So previously in the gym, we used to think that one needed to use as heavy a weight as possible to failure. Okay,
to failure was the big word. For our listening audience, failure,
right,
failure in sports is not the same as failure in life. It has a technical meaning. Can you explain that?
Failure in sports or in weightlifting simply means one cannot do another repetition with the weight he or she is using.
Mm-hmm.
That's simply what failure means.
That's the advantage of spotting. Spotting, because when you're on doing bench pressing, failure could mean the bar is on your neck, and that's not a good place for it to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because once you fail, you cannot execute another repetition. So if you're in a situation where you're bench pressing or you're squatting and you fail, you can't get the weight back up. So that's where a spotter comes into play.
Right,
so,
right.
So that's what we used to think, that, you needed to use a really heavy weight to failure. But recent data shows us that one does not need to use extremely heavy weight. You can use 30% of your one rep max, which means, say for instance, a person can maximally bench press 100 pounds, take 30% of that, 30 pounds or so, and if you take 30% of your one rep max and take that to failure, one can still achieve muscle hypertrophy or increased muscle size, and increased strength. So that was a huge finding that's come out in the last couple of years.
So if I can rephrase it, let's use the example of the 30 pounds, which is, I'm not quite that wussy, but that's more my league for the bench press. If I did, so I do 30 pounds to like, 25, 30 times to the point where my arms are tremulous, I can no longer hold it up. That's going to actually cause my muscles to grow and be strong?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It will. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so that's encouraging.
That's a really great finding. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, there are a myriad of ways. So if usually, conventionally speaking, if one wants to increase mostly muscle strength and not necessarily be concerned with muscle size, then we'll follow more of a, what's called a weightlifting or Olympic lifting type of protocol, which means a lower rep range, somewhere around singles or one rep, two reps, three reps, up to five reps, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If one is concerned about muscle size and strength, more mm-hmm. of a traditional bodybuilding type of approach, then you're talking 8, 9, 10 reps, up to 12 reps. That's a conventional approach, and that approach holds across the population for the most part.
You know what's interesting is that in the aesthetics of these incredible weightlifters in Olympic competition, they don't look particularly shredded. I think is the term.
Right.
They don't have that perfect muscle depth. They're big, they're strong, but they have sort of softer contours than amateur professional bodybuilders.
Right. That's right. That's absolutely true. And part of that has to do with the type of training they do. As I mentioned before, low rep ranges has mm-hmm. a little bit to do with that. But probably the biggest thing is the nutrition component.
Okay.
Bodybuilders pay strict attention to what he or she eats in order to achieve the lowest body fat possible. And even in the off season, we want to look a certain way. So again, we really monitor what we eat, the macronutrient breakdown, et cetera, to keep our body fat relatively low. Whereas traditional powerlifters, weightlifters, Olympic lifters, they usually aren't as concerned about mm-hmm. about aesthetic. Mm-hmm. They're more concerned about strength.
Right.
So they might
carbo load and they might have more calories overall. Let's explode a myth here, which is that carbo loading is essential for athletic performance. True or false?
That's definitely false. That used to be the go-to route for especially endurance athletes, but probably in the last, 5 years or so, that myth has definitely been exposed and exploded, and hopefully not too many people do that anymore. But it's certainly not necessary to carbo load night before an endurance race. Usually, the best recommendation now is to simply eat what one normally eats and maybe increase the carb intake a bit, but certainly not bowls of pasta or mm-hmm. whatever the carbohydrate is in vogue for that night or whatever. Just keep it simple, this typical meal, and maybe increase your carb content a bit. That's
okay.
Really what all needs to do.
This is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts, but I want to explore more the role of diet and nutrition in exercise, and there's a lot more to say on that subject. Today's guest is Dr. DeWade Perry. He's a medical doctor. He practices in Eugene, Oregon. It's a good point, DeWade, for you to mention your practice. Is your practice, obviously your general practice of functional medicine, you do a lot of what I do for not even particularly athletic patients, but you do consult with amateur and possibly some professional athletes. Is your practice open to people from all over the country?
It is, absolutely. And I also have ability to do virtual consults with patients too, so that helps them a lot.
What's the 411 on that? How do you get in touch with your practice?
My phone number is 541-255-3205. And also, I'm available via Skype to do Skype sessions with patients.
Okay. We'll pause now, and when we return, more on the subject of exercise. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.